New government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulation.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory activity.
$1.8 trillion. That's how much
business centers and bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are massive.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Federal Society's Free Lunch podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. My name is William Hild, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Regulatory Transparency Project. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the guest speakers on today's call. We've been looking forward to this afternoon's discussion entitled Exploring the Regulatory Thicket. Regulation is a pervasive and increasingly a contentious issue in 21st century America. The propriety of any given regulatory imposition may be debatable. However, in this discussion, we address the bigger questions about how regulation works as a whole, whether in the aggregate, regulation at the federal, state, and local level is working well, or impacting innovation and economic opportunity. What are the relative benefits of local and state regulation as well as the societal costs? Today, we will explore whether we should maintain the status quo, seek to scale back existing regulations, and or winnow existing regulatory regimes. Our first guest is Luke Wake, staff attorney at the NFIB Small Business Legal Center. Luke is also the chair of the Regulatory Transparency Project's Working Group on State and Local Regulation. We are also excited and pleased to have with us Brooks Rainwater, who is the senior executive and director of the National League of Cities Center for City Solutions. If you would like to learn more about Luke or Brooks and their interesting work, please visit regproject.org, where we have listed their full bios. I will turn it over first to Luke to get us started. After opening remarks and discussion between our speakers, we will go to audience Q&A. So audience members, please think of what you'd like to ask our speakers. Thank you both for joining us. Luke, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. And, you know, as an attorney for the NFIB, you know, we represent small business owners all across the country with the NFIB Small Business Legal Center. So I'm constantly talking to small business owners about their regulatory issues throughout the country. And as the chair of Federalist Society's State and Local Regulation Working Group within the RTP project, we've been charged with writing a series of white papers highlighting regulatory problems and more specifically trying to shine a light on regimes where the costs and the burdens imposed in society outweigh the societal benefits. So most recently we released this Managing the Regulatory Thicket paper, which I encourage everyone to read, in which we argue that there really is a problem, a systemic problem of overregulation in this country. And we refer to this concept of the regulatory thicket because I think there's a real sense, especially for entrepreneurs and small business owners, who, by the way, those guys don't have in-house attorneys or compliance experts, and they certainly can't afford to run to an attorney every time something comes up. There's a sense that they're swimming in regulation and that it's essentially impossible to be 100% compliant 100% of the time. And I think that's especially true in jurisdictions like California where, they're constantly piling on. So, when I use the term regulatory thicket, that's what I'm talking about here, this phenomena where, small business entrepreneurs, have to navigate through, layers and layers of regulation at the federal level, which is already, very cumbersome. Federal regulation covers almost, every aspect of economic life today in some way. But then there's the state and local regulation on top of that. And again, in an environment where there's, constant change, and that makes it more difficult on a day-to-day basis. So in this paper, we argued that, we need to think proactively about how to control the growth of the regulatory state. And again, specifically, we're talking here about state and local regulation because, there are forces and incentives that inevitably will push for more and more regulation. Madison would call these factions. I think today we'll refer to them as special interests. But whatever it would be. And I think, also exacerbating the problem is this tendency, I think, a lot of times for legislators to come into office and think that they're not doing their job if they're not, creating new laws. And maybe if they're thinking seriously and critically about this regulatory thicket issue, they will maybe change that attitude. So I'm going to share just a few insights that I think, you know, we gathered in our work on this paper. One is that I think there's a ratcheting effect. So regulation usually is a one-way ratchet. You know, it's relatively easy to pile on new regulatory impositions, but it's often, you know, exceedingly difficult to eliminate these regimes or to have real reform. And relatedly, you know, us attorneys, you know, we know that it's extremely difficult to expect any sort of change from the courts. Courts are extremely deferential to legislative bodies and usually deferential also to administrative agencies at, you know, both the state and the federal level. So, and just as a concrete example of, I think, the ratchet effect, I realize this is a federal example, but, you know, the Affordable Care Act was an extremely controversial, major piece of legislation at the federal level, but there was, you know, tremendous opposition to it and grassroots, support for repeal. Nonetheless, you know, that has gone nowhere, and it's the law of the land and probably will continue to be so. So my second observation about the regulatory thicket is in the phenomena of this is the clutter. So regulations have a tendency to build up and ossify over time. You know, and this is true both in blue states and in red states. And in the same way that, you know, clutter will slowly take over your home if you're not proactively looking for ways to tidy up on a continual basis. So, if left unchecked, the natural course is for the clutter to become more and more cumbersome to the point that it really is stifling and beginning to get in the way. And I think that's precisely the problem that entrepreneurs and small business owners are struggling with when they're trying to grow and establish their business. This is the regulatory, you know, environment that's just stifling them. And my third point, and it's related, is that a large part of the problem here is that we're dealing with not a static environment, but a changing environment. So, you know, I think the regulatory environment is especially challenging for small businesses in these jurisdictions where lawmakers are more indulgent of regulatory innovation. It's difficult enough, I think, for an entrepreneur to, you know, fully understand and be, you know, totally compliant with the law, even in a static environment. But when regulatory landscape is, you know, changing year to year, it's really easy to make costly mistakes just because you didn't realize that there was a change. And then, you know, especially it's problematic if you, you know, face lawsuits or whatnot as a result of that. And I have to emphasize for a moment here that, this sort of regulatory environment, you know, gives an inherent competitive advantage to large businesses over small businesses because they can better absorb the costs of compliance and, you know, because they have access to the resources to navigate these regimes in a way that small businesses don't. The reality is a small business, without in-house attorneys, without in-house HR, it's the owner themselves that are usually pulled away from much more productive things that they could be doing and spending inordinate time and energy, you know, trying to figure out what to do. My fourth point here in observation is about what I call balkanization, and that is that the regulatory environment is especially challenging in these jurisdictions that allow for local and municipal authorities to pile on regulation on top of federal and state. So we see this phenomenon most in the bluest of blue states, really, where you see already very stringent regulatory standards in place as a matter of state law. And then these, you know, local municipalities balkanize with their own sometimes inconsistent rules in a way that really makes it, you know, cumbersome and often exceedingly difficult for businesses that have multiple locations or a mobile workforce. So you could be, you know, have your base of operations in a neighboring community and you know, have business just greatly complicated by the fact that, you know, you're sending people in to do jobs here and there. My fifth observation about, you know, in describing the regulatory thicket and the phenomena we're talking about is that it's not any one regulation or regulatory regime that's stifling economic dynamism in America. It's really the aggregate effect of all that regulation, so death by a thousand cuts. We're not talking about, you know, it's a systemic problem in need of a systemic solution. So, you know, by its nature, the regulatory thicket is comprised of, you know, many, many regulations that may very well be, you know, well-intentioned, and you know, many of them are defensible if viewed on a granular level. But, you know, in considering the totality of regulation and the aggregate and this phenomena that we're calling the regulatory thicket, there is a compelling case for regulatory measures that may winnow the field of regulation or at least control the growth of regulation. So, you know, at the very least, you know, when we're considering the propriety of, you know, new regulation, new proposals, you know, one has to bear in mind that it would be piling on. And I think that this should give, you know, lawmakers pause, that they should, you know, stop to question whether it really is, you know, a compelling enough concern to justify, you know, contributing further to the thicket. And my sixth point is, about unreasonable complications. So insofar as they're going to move forward with new regulation, the regulatory thicket is exacerbated in these cases where the government, where they're cited public concerns, but they could address those through less burdensome alternatives. You know, again, there's often room for reasonable minds to disagree on particular regulation, and we all realize that. But I think we should all be able to agree that if regulation really is necessary, that the state should be seeking to achieve its ends while minimizing the burdens and disruptions for the small business community, especially. And to provide just one concrete illustrative example, numerous states have implemented this ban the box legislation that prohibits employers from running background checks until after a job applicant has been given a tentative offer. But California has complicated things in the hiring process even further by dictating very specific steps and waiting periods and notices that are very easy to trip up on. And again, if you need to, have a new you want someone to go in there and change the drywall tomorrow, it's a practical matter very cumbersome to have to worry about all these things and then face the possibility of a lawsuit over a good faith mistake. And that brings me to our seventh observation about the proportionality of penalties. So the regulatory thicket is also exacerbated by the fact that many state and local regimes, punish even good faith violations with what I would call shock and awe penalties, or by creating punitive causes of action. For example, I spoke with a small business owner who runs a shop here in California selling sporting goods. And at some point, he had California Air Resources Boards come in, and they told him that he was in violation of some regulation that he had no idea about, never heard of, but apparently it made him illegal for him to sell an electric bike that he had in stock. And he was told that he faced $37,500 per day in penalties for each bike in his inventory and for each one he had sold. And these are, bikes that he had maybe $100 profit on. So, relatedly, while we're talking about the penalties, a major component of the problem with regulation and the proportionality of the penalties is these states that have a tendency to create causes of action for benign regulatory mistakes. And California provides a whole litany of examples. I mean, I could talk to you about the California Private Attorney General Act, which authorizes lawsuits over such innocuous mistakes as misstating, listing your doing business as name instead of your official incorporated name on the employee's pay stubs. The reality is, you could achieve in most cases the very same regulatory objectives without authorizing the cause of action, and which is usually punitively expensive. I mean, people have to pay $20,000 or $30,000 often to prove that they did everything right in a lawsuit. So I've been talking for a while. I certainly have other things I can say on this, but I do want to hand things over to Brooks, who will talk for a little bit here.
Great. Thanks so much. And it's wonderful to be with you all today. And thank you for inviting me to this conversation. Again, I'm Brooks Rainwater, and I'm the Senior Executive and Director of the Center for City Solutions here at the National League of Cities. And the center that I oversee works on research, technical assistance, on-the-ground engagement with city officials, as well as leadership education. We do this across a wide range of issues, from kind of traditional issues like economic development, infrastructure and transportation, to all of kind of the changes we're seeing within kind of the urban innovation space, thinking about, mobility shifts around Uber, autonomous vehicles, ride-hailing, scooters, and more. And so I really want to start with the premise today that decision-making that takes place closest to the people is the best type of decision-making that can happen in a well-functioning democracy. It's reflective of people's wants and needs, and poll after poll shows that people support local elected officials at higher levels than their counterparts at the state and national level. This is why local control, local decision-making, and local regulation make sense and are able to best reflect the will of the people electing our leaders to represent their interests, not special interests in government. And so if this is my baseline premise, the purpose of regulation in a well-functioning society is to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the general public. That being said, there are too many regulations placed on Americans that want to start and grow businesses in the aggregate, and there are a multitude of ways they can be adjusted but not decimated. The regulatory thicket may have grown a tad bit too much, but rather than taking the hedge clippers out and cutting deeply into what is working and working successfully, I would posit that a pair of scissors to trim judiciously would suffice and create a better environment for all. Because ultimately, there is a concern that if you trim the regulatory thicket too much, you create holes in the policies that make sure our food is safe, the products we use don't kill us, and the people placed in positions of most importance watching our children, taking care of the elderly, and protecting the general welfare are not properly vetted. And the end result in that type of limited regulatory environment is ultimately deleterious on society. So I would like to explore the regulatory environment and its impact on entrepreneurship and innovation at multiple levels, global, national, state, and local. First, if we take the global and the national levels, I believe that we need to ask ourselves a foundational question. If the U.S. regulatory regime is strangling entrepreneurship and impeding innovation, what is the model that you would recommend? In other words, what and where are we comparing the U.S. to in order to come to these conclusions that regulation is holding us back? From a global perspective, America consistently ranked at the top of the pack for entrepreneurship and innovation. The Global Entrepreneurship Index, which is done by the Global Entrepreneurship and Development Institute, ranks the U.S. as number one in entrepreneurship. Following out and rounding out that top five, U.S. at one, Switzerland, Canada, UK, Australia. The Global Innovation Index has the U.S. at number six, which is actually down from number four in 2017, even as we've been cutting regulation at the federal level. So there we see the top five being Switzerland, Netherlands, Sweden, UK, and Singapore before we get to the U.S. So again, what we're starting to see with these trends are actually more highly regulated states, like in Europe, are actually leading on innovation entrepreneurship at some instances, and then in other instances, the U.S. is on top. And I'll give one more to reinforce this point. U.S. News and World Report entrepreneurship ranking has America at number three. So now that we've established that America is indeed the top of rankings and has been consistently over the years, let's drill down to the state and local level, particularly to some of the challenges raised with examples given in the regulatory thicket paper. So at the state and local level, I would really posit that the state level is where we could do some trimming and devolve more authority to the local level. I say that, obviously I'm an urbanist and feel like things should be, decision-making should be taken at the state, at the city level rather than state. But before we get into that, I wanted to speak directly to some of the examples in the thicket paper. Examples are given, and I really love these examples, of Dan's Hamburgers, Amy's Ice Cream, and Wild Jimmy's Sausage and Beef Jerky, and the challenges they are facing. These budding entrepreneurs all agree about one thing, quote, if they knew before what they've learned through hard experience, they would never have started or expanded their businesses. You know, and I just take a little bit of issue with this as a premise, because while their concerns are valid, the southern region of the country where these businesses were located has arguably the thinnest regulatory thicket in the country. So again, what and where would we be comparing states like Alabama, Florida, and Georgia to? Generally, these places in the south are compared to California or maybe New York in the northeast, where regulation can at times be a bit more stringent. But according to the Kauffman Foundation, states like California, often spoken about in terms of its regulatory challenges, actually have the highest rate of new entrepreneurs at 0.44% of the population, and high numbers of startup early job creation at 6.56 jobs on average created by startups in their first year. Also, I think that again, looking at the global rankings of entrepreneurship and innovation, America is clearly at or near the top. So we should celebrate that we're doing well as a country within this space, make changes, but also just hew back to the fact that America is number one or near number one. In fact, again, I would posit that the state government is the real problem, where we might want to try to trim the regulatory thicket or indeed create more dynamic space for cities to innovate. And the way that we can do that is by curbing state-level preemption, not leaning into it. State-level preemption has been on the rise across the country. Our research shows this, a lot of other people that have dug into this, particularly in those states where politics diverges between states and cities. And state preemption is too often the result of legislative capture by existing incumbents. Policy that is driven by incumbents is rarely designed to empower insurgents and is rarely there to help kind of create a better entrepreneurial environment. Instead, it's there generally to help large corporations that are trying to kind of move forward with regulatory capture. And there's currently a great lack of evidence that preemption actually helps solve any problems. And in fact, for all the conversation about a patchwork of regulation impeding companies bandied about, these arguments are largely built on belief rather than fact. We are in the midst of exploring research in this very space that will be coming out later this year, which seeks to answer questions around preemption's impact on the entrepreneurial environment, and look forward to sharing that with you all once completed. Because this current dynamic of increased preemption against cities has actually tamped down on dynamism and impeded the ability of cities to regulate based on the needs and priorities of local citizenry. you know, why should a state government regulate how a local community zones for property, as is increasingly happening in states to allow businesses to proffer short-term rentals? Why should a state government stop cities like Chattanooga from expanding high-speed broadband access outside of its city limits to smaller communities that would like access to gigabit-level internet at affordable prices that is actually not being offered by private actors? Why should states like we have seen in Arizona be so heavy-handed that they are limiting the ability of cities to even fight against onerous state-level regulations, to where if they bring suit and lose, they can face punitive fines? And then why in the world should a state like we saw in North Carolina and others try to do regulate who can use what bathroom? Not only is this an overreach that makes no sense from a policy and human rights perspective, but from a knock-on economic perspective, it impeded the businesses across the country that wanted to site there from moving there due to a lack of inclusiveness enshrined in law. So all of these examples of state-level impediments to local decision-making take me back to the original premise, which is that while there should be movement afoot to trim the regulatory environment we have here in America, we should remember that when it comes to how America ranks in the world, we're either at the top or near the top for innovation and entrepreneurship. Much of this comes from the fact that America's federal system is a success and has been built this way over generations. How did America get to be at or near the top of the world? We started small and scaled up, always starting in a city and then expanding these good ideas, whether in business or policy, to the state, national, and global level. We should celebrate local innovation, not impede it. Thank you all.
Well, thanks, Brooks. And I will just take a couple minutes to maybe respond to some of what you've said, and I'll let you do the same to respond to what I say, and then maybe we'll just have a conversation for a little bit. But I'm going to respond to a few of these things here. First, you know, what is the baseline that we're comparing, I'm comparing this to, you know, in part the regulatory environment that we think would be optimal. I would say would be a whole lot less federal regulation. but secondly, and so maybe we might agree on that part. I don't know. It seems to me that our greatest point of sort of disagreement is probably over this issue of the propriety of preempting local municipal regulation. I have to respond to one other point before I tackle the preemption thing, and that is, you know, we're not advocating in this regulatory thick of paper getting rid of, you know, all regulation. What we're talking about is revisiting the existing regulation to say, is this really necessary? I mean, if there really are compelling, you know, health and safety concerns, you know, we're not saying throw those out the window. But even so far as there are, we're saying, are there ways that we could address those concerns that would be less burdensome? And often the case is yes. With regard to the preemption issue. So, again, I would argue, first of all, that it is best public policy to generally preempt local regulation, at least of commercial activity. Zoning is quintessentially local in nature, and so I don't necessarily disagree with my counterpart here. But in terms of, you know, regulation of, you know, business activity vis-a-vis the business, I think it's bad for the state's overall business climate if you have inconsistent rules from one, you know, municipality to the next. I mean, you could have 300, you know, different, you know, sets of rules for businesses, and that would be exceedingly complicated and difficult. Related on this point, you know, if local government is given a free hand, you know, we can inevitably expect that sort of balkanization because, you know, it's easier for special interest groups, I think, to co-opt and to lobby to, you know, local officials to affect change that otherwise state lawmakers have judged to be imprudent. And often they've, you know, that's when, and by the way, this is a very timely conversation, because, you know, we live in an age of gridlock in Washington, D.C., for better or for worse. You know, if you are like me and you want to see deregulation at the federal level, well, it's frustrating that Congress can't get much done. But, you know, there are a lot of people who are frustrated that Congress isn't, you know, piling on more regulation at the federal level. I get that. But the reality is not a whole lot's going on in D.C. And so what we are seeing on the ground nationally is that all of the regulatory action, most of the regulatory action is happening at the state and especially the local level. So what you know, there's a lot of action in the various state legislatures, and it does seem like there's a real at this level a very stark distinction between the blue states and the red states. Different sets of issues. Now there's still things happening in the red states, and there's definitely a problem of ossification of just regulation that's grown up over time there. But my counterpart is right that things in Georgia and Texas are different than in California. Although one of the examples he was citing about from Texas was dealing with the city of Austin, I believe, which was made things exceedingly complicated. But getting back to my point. Look, if local government's given a free hand, we can just expect, as a practical matter, that they're going to pile on and create more complicated rules for people, and it's going to what we see is that it actually enables dominant cities to effectively establish regional rules. If San Jose is establishing its own minimum wage, which is again higher than these people who want the higher minimum wage in San Jose. They didn't think that the state of California, which already had a incredibly high minimum wage, was going far enough. And so, in the meantime, they have effectively set a default regional standard because employers next door either have to, they have to worry about losing prospective employees in this labor market to San Jose, or they've got mobile employees themselves and they've got to track down to the minute how long those employees are in San Jose in order to be compliant. Either that or just always pay them San Jose wages. And then, there's a paid sick leave and, a whole host of things that we're seeing, regulation of things that have traditionally been handled at the state and federal level. There at the local, and just with regard to this idea that it's inherently better to have things done at the local level, I would just mention that is sort of a lot of conservatives I talk to, there's this tendency to reflexively say local government is better, and that might be true with some things, but I think it's when we're talking, but in an age where we're so interconnected, I think when we're talking about business activity, we should especially maybe question that premise. And I would suggest that good government has to be defined about what best serves the common good, and specifically individuals. But I don't think that more regulation is always going to serve the common good, and I think that's the phenomena you see where you have the local entities allowed to do more and more regulation. So I'm going to let my colleague respond to me.
Sure. So I think I'll start with where you ended, which is more regulation doesn't always positively affect the common good. And I think that I would completely agree with you on that point. Specifically when we talk about something like San Jose having a higher minimum wage and creating a default regional standard, fundamentally, I don't see why that's a bad thing when the San Jose region is the number two most economically vibrant place in the country. I think the median income is around $125,000 a year. And so you have a very unique set of circumstances that's going to be different than, say, Stockton, California, or other inland parts of California. And wages may and probably should reflect that. Similar to your point about things in Georgia and Texas being different than California, these variations happen both within states as well as between states. And since the 1970s, we've seen a large divergence between income levels in our largest metropolitan areas versus other parts of the country. I think there's more of a need to make sure that's properly reflected in how people are paid where they happen to live. You could go state by state thinking about New York City versus Albany and the cost of living in both places. As I said, you can do this in most states with large cities versus more rural parts of the state. And so while you kind of posit that the best policy is to prevent business regulation activity, and that's where preemption is actually a good thing, while I'm still hoping to see what our research shows around this very question, I do get curious about the question of whether what you're doing is helping large business kind of solidify their hold on kind of a national business perspective rather than helping small businesses thrive. And back to kind of the broadband question, whether it's either a municipal broadband scheme trying to expand beyond their jurisdiction or whether it's a smaller incumbent that might want to get into the marketplace, that's incredibly difficult when the state level regulation that often looks very similar in multiple states because of state level lobbyists on behalf of business making similar cases, I get curious on whether that's actually impeding innovation and entrepreneurship rather than helping to kind of make it go further. Your point on it being an age of gridlock in Washington, D.C., yes, it definitely is, and we've started to see that transfer more and more to the state level over recent years. You know, I remember back in the 1990s when states were seen as the laboratories of innovation. It seems like since the 1990s, cities have taken up that mantle, and states have almost been a barrier on both sides of the issue rather than helping kind of smooth innovation and economic creation, economic development. In many cases, they actually can impede that. So I think that the best policy would be to kind of smooth that over and have states and cities work better, because coordinated efforts, particularly on something like paid sick leave, are going to be much, much better than just San Francisco having a policy rather than the full state of California having a policy. And frankly, I think that the reason why cities have led on so many of these issues is because the federal government gave up on its traditional role with minimum wage and many of these issues years ago. It's very much a bipartisan issue that neither side's been able to come up with the solutions that people in poll after poll are demanding. And so, you know, city leaders, mayors in particular, have taken it on themselves to lead. And I think that again gets at where a better local state relationship could take these policies that we incubate at the local level and make them go more broadly across the state. And then kind of hewing back to this idea of states being the laboratory of innovation, we could see how this plays out in a very different way in, say, Kansas versus California, and create national policy that's reflective of this. So if anything, I think where we would agree is to kind of counter this gridlock, it would be great to see government work better again, because I think that's broadly where the failings have come, and you know, the different levels of government are trying to kind of fill gaps rather than necessarily do what they would do in an optimal situation.
Yeah. Well, I would, and I guess we'll just have a conversation here now. I think, you know, one of my thoughts that came to mind when you were just talking about San Jose and sort of the need for you know, maybe a higher minimum wage in San Jose versus Stockton is the cost of living. I mean, the cost of living is higher in San Jose, and then the Bay Area in general also as a result of regulatory problems. I mean, you know, the fact that regulation in California, both state and local level regulation, make it so exceedingly difficult to build any new housing, on top of all sorts of, you know, regulation that actually affects the price of consumer goods throughout California, which makes California more expensive than living in, say, North Carolina. You know, those are societal costs that, you know, and so this all becomes like a snowball effect, if you will. I do question this premise that, you know, limiting trying to winnow the field of regulation, or at least hold, you know, more of a static environment, that somehow benefits established businesses. But I say this because, you know, look, I'm not an economist, but as a matter of common sense, and as well as the economic research I've seen, says that the more regulations that you put up, the more roadblocks you put up for someone trying to, you know, establish and run a legitimate business, the more difficult you make it, especially for someone who doesn't have a lot of resources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, to that point, I think that there could be a case to be made for kind of routinizing the regulatory regime across the state. I would just argue that the most economically vibrant part of that state should be in the lead on figuring out how that regulatory environment might look. And that's where the divergence with what you've seen with state preemption is, that oftentimes the economic centers, the metropolitan regions within that state, are being overridden by the rural interests in the state, where a lot of the economic activity actually isn't taking place. And so that's where I think that the divergence in how policies are being implemented if there was more of kind of a political convergence on how to approach these things, you might be able to get a more optimal outcome.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and obviously we do disagree on on this preemption issue quite a bit. I mean, again, there are certainly some things that I would agree are quintessentially local in nature and, you know, zoning, I agree. I mean, I might have probably a much more restrained view of what a proper zoning regime would do than you. But the bottom line for me is that when it comes to, you know, a lot of the sort of, you talk about, you know, these cities taking the lead on things, I think, you know, that this, you know, when we're talking about, for example, minimum wage or, you know, paid sick leave, I mean, there's nothing, you know, sort of quintessentially local in its concern when it comes to those issues. And again, you have, you know, a default. You know, there's other models you could look at. I mean, even aside from the municipal thing, I mean, Oregon, for example, has done something kind of interesting with these regional, you know, to address the regional concerns you've mentioned. But when you have state lawmakers, you know, either, you know, balk at the idea of imposing new regulation or set what they think is, you know, already a controversial, for at least in some quarters, you know, new minimum wage or whatever, you have, you know, a consensus from the elected officials who ultimately are supposed to represent the interests of the people as a whole of the state. And, you know, ultimately sovereignty, you know, as getting a little legalistic on you here, but I mean, ultimately sovereignty rests in the people of the state collectively. And, you know, and the cities are, you know, are sort of chartered, but they have to, I think, be subordinate to, you know, the sovereign will of the people of the state as a whole.
No, and I would not try to kind of counter the argument that the way our federal system is structured isn't, you know, a positive benefit to society. What I think has, you know, actually gotten a little out of whack, though, is the political and economic power within any given state are not lining up the way they used to be. And there's a lot of reasons for that: gerrymandering, kind of the political environment that we live in, the lack of people working across the aisle within the state level, just like at the federal level. I mean, all of these things come into play. And so, again, it's not that we wouldn't want to have an optimal environment where the regulatory regimes aren't smoothed across the entire state. It's just a question of what is the model that you would go on in a state like Tennessee? Is it looking at your biggest cities and what seems to be working there from an economic perspective, and then making regulation that meets that across the state? Or is it looking at, you know, the smaller communities in the state and the legislators that represent those coming into Nashville and Chattanooga and others and saying, this is how policy should be made? Because I don't think we're in an environment right now where at the state level, many of the legislators on either side are representing the full scope of what's happening within the state, that people have very much gone into their respective corners rather than coming together to legislate on these types of matters.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to, I mean, I don't want to, you know, exclusively dwell on this preemption issue. I mean, that's, you know, that's one of a couple recommendations that, that, you know, we highlighted in this working, you know, this white paper, of things that could be done to cut back on the regulatory thinking. But there are other things that we talked about. And it seems like we have some agreement, that, you know, the state level regulation is a significant part of the problem. So, you know, there are things that we think could be done there. For example, having sort of a regulatory budget like Canada and the UK have experimented with, and now the Trump administration have actually systematically going through and, you know, either trying to systematically eliminate regulation that maybe is outdated or is maybe unnecessarily cumbersome, or to, you know, say, you know, put some sort of controls on for every new regulation, we got to eliminate one. So there are things like that can be done, I mean, short of legislative changes. And then the other thing I would just point out here is that there's, you know, one thing we both talk about, you know, the need for good government. I think we maybe have slightly different ideas about what optimal government would look like, but one thing I think should be able to agree on is that insofar as we're going to have a complicated regulatory regimes, well, hopefully we're trying to make them less complicated and more straightforward, but also hopefully we're giving people, you know, guidance to help them understand this stuff in a way that they can find easily and rely upon.
Yeah, no, I think I agree with you there, and that there are ways to address many of these concerns that are less burdensome. I mean, one of the points I want to go back to that you rose a little earlier too was when you're looking at kind of the research you're doing or the way that you approached it, you're comparing it to an optimal environment. From your standpoint and perspective, have you seen throughout the United States particular places where we're close to that optimal environment, and what's happening within those contexts that's not happening in other places?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, look, again, I'm not an economist. We do have some within this regulatory thicket paper. We have some bright economists who were involved with that, and we do have a section talking about economic dynamism and the fact that overly restrictive regulatory regimes and just this aggregation of regulation do tend to have a stifling effect on the economy and on people. For example, you know, a concrete example of that, you know, and again, occupational licensing comes to mind, as the economic research on that shows very clearly that, you know, where you have, you know, more restrictive regimes, it impedes movement between, you know, people from, you know, and impedes economic activity. You know, so in a granular, you know, I could hone in on different sort of studies on specific forms of regulation. For example, overly restrictive zoning regimes, and this is quintessentially a local issue, but overly restrictive zoning regimes in major metropolitan cities, you know, studies show actually has a negative effect on U.S. GDP. So, I mean, there is an economic impact. I mean, what I would say specifically to your question is that what I see is that, you know, a lot of businesses are, you know, moving from a place like California to a place like Texas, probably in large part because of the regulatory environment.
Yeah. I mean, I think what kind of counters that at times is the amalgamation effect of people wanting to be near others within the space that they're in. And so you continue to see the startup activity in a state like California outpacing many other states. But you're right, there is that transfer of businesses due to kind of high cost. You know, and I think you're right as well on kind of the regulatory regimes within communities leading to higher costs on housing. And it's an issue that we've been very concerned about and working with mayors throughout the country to kind of address, because I do believe that, you know, from the local perspective, we want to do all that we can to make sure that more people can live in communities, can afford to live in those communities. And, you know, while we're creating lots and lots of jobs in our major metropolitan areas, oftentimes housing construction isn't keeping up, leading to some real divergence and challenges for people to be able to live and work within the same areas. So, yeah, I think there is a bit that we also agree with on these matters, too. And I think, too, when you look at, like, the state level rent seeking that takes place on, you know, everything from kind of, you know, car dealerships to beauty salons, that there are areas, when I talked about taking the scissors out and kind of trimming, that I think you could definitely see where the thicket has grown to a perspective that it probably doesn't need to be as broad. And I think, you know, across the spectrum, it's thinking about where would you make changes like that. But on the other side of it, where do you make sure that you're strengthening the social safety net so entrepreneurship can actually flourish? You know, you mentioned the Affordable Care Act earlier in a completely different context, but one of the things that comes out to me, regardless of what you think about it as a policy, is a lot of the work that I've done on the on-demand economy and kind of the broader gig economy. Companies like Uber and Lyft and Airbnb and others wouldn't have been able to thrive as much if not for the fact that people were more willing to leave other jobs and take on gigs because they had health insurance covered through a government program rather than having to have it attached to their work. So I think there's kind of a push-pull that needs to take place to make these things optimal.
You raise an interesting point. specifically with regard to, you know, the ACA, I mean, like, you know, the small business owners that, you know, NFIB represents about, you know, 300,000 small business owners across the country, and, you know, the, you know, cost of health insurance, you know, was and has all the more, you know, been, you know, sort of a highest concern. We actually have a research foundation that has a problems and priorities problems and priorities survey that they do. They list 75 potential problems and priorities, and they ask a small, and this is a quadrennial survey, so every 4 years. And it's interesting because we can actually go back and track what the concerns of small business are. And these are immensely practical people, right? And you know, the cost of health insurance remains right up there, but both before and after the ACA. But unreasonable regulation is consistently at the top of the list. You know, is right up there with taxes. And, you know, what I always wonder, you know, when people say unreasonable regulation, what do they mean? I think maybe people, you know, anytime someone's dealing with a headache that, you know, it's giving them a headache, they might call it unreasonable, sure. But I think trying to be more precise, I think, is helpful. And again, so that we've endeavored to, you know, give basically, I think, a formula for identifying what is unreasonable regulation. And I would suggest, again, it's regulation that doesn't really either achieve any specific, you know, the cited public goals. It just doesn't further them, or it does so in such an attenuated way that you have to question whether the benefits of the regulation, you know, are worth the imposition, the burden on society, especially when it is contributing to this regulatory thing. And then again, I keep coming back to this idea that regulation should be viewed as unreasonable if it's more complicated than it needs to be, or if it's more punitive than it needs to be. And because, you know, that's so often the case. I mean, you know, just going back for a second to, you know, the municipal regulation again. I mean, this, you know, Los Angeles, you know, has its own minimum wage. Just do a number, you know, I think like 25 different municipalities here in California. And in LA, if you violate, you know, if you inadvertently, you know, don't realize that, you know, you needed to, you know, pay those truck drivers who were driving through and, you know, making one delivery in LA, you know, that you need to actually be paying the minimum wage for the little bit of time they were working in LA, because, you know, it kicks in after, you know, so many hours worked in there. Well, over, you know, the course of a year, the employee hits it. So let's say you had 15 employees that you didn't realize that you were supposed to be paying minimum wage on, and they're paid, you know, they're fined, it can be up to $170 for each employee that, for every day that the violation occurred. So let's say you have 15 employees and you just didn't realize that they needed to be paid, you know, a heightened minimum wage under LA's standard. That would be $2,550 per day for those 15 employees. And, you know, if the mistake, you didn't realize you were making the mistake, that mistake could go on for quite a while. Say just a month, it would be almost $80,000 in penalties for a good faith mistake. And these are penalties that are imposed, you know, on top of requiring the employer to pay back wages. So, I mean, obviously the employer in that situation has to, you know, pay back what was owed, but these are penalties on top of it just to be punitive for, you know, in this situation, a good faith mistake. And that, again, that's liability that they wouldn't even bear if we were just dealing with the state law, which is, you know, sort of heavy-handed enough. But
yeah, I mean, I think I understand your perspective. I think I go back to, again, that the divergence in income levels and cost of living in places throughout a given state often necessitate different income levels, you know, whether we're talking about the minimum wage or whether we're talking about what it costs to pay a coder. And so I think the challenge comes into play that people at the lower end of the income spectrum are feeling the brunt of kind of larger technological changes and kind of workforce shifts more than others. And so unfortunately, the competitive space that they are a part of within kind of the income drivers, it just isn't there in the same way. And so having cities come in and offer, you know, higher minimum wages to help counteract that is, I would say, a net good, even if you have some of the stickiness and challenges that you're raising with a company that may be doing business only part of the time within that community. Is it optimal? Would it be better that the whole state of California had a $15 minimum wage? Possibly. You know, I'm not trying to make the case that you wouldn't want to scale what you're seeing in a few of the larger metro areas, but it would definitely have a larger impact if you went on the most high cost part of the state and kind of regularized that across the full state. You know, it would be a net positive for low wage workers. But then you would, I would imagine, make a different case on behalf of the business owner that now has to pay that added cost throughout the entire state. So it's kind of how you deal with that as a challenge can be a little bit tricky.
Right. Well, and again, this, you know, as I said, a lot of, you know, any specific regulatory regime, you know, there's going to be proponents. There's always going to be, you know, defensible or at least, you know, arguably defensible on a granular level. Right. My point in raising the LA example was not necessarily my views are already very clear on, you know, the value of preemption, but more to emphasize the idea that, you know, insofar as LA is going to do this, okay, then, you know, make it as simple as possible for one, but provide good guidance. But also, you know, if someone's made a good faith mistake, I mean, the answer shouldn't be to hit them with, you know, such ruinous penalties that they face the possibility of going bankrupt. Especially, it should be an educational moment. I realize something like minimum wage, people will say, well, that's pretty cut and dry. Maybe they should get that. But there's a whole host of very innocuous mistakes that, you know, people don't realize that, you know, I needed a Prop 65 warning for this. I mean, I'm talking about state law now here, but, you know, and I could give, you know, I have these conversations with people all the time. I mean, some of them blow me away. I talked to a guy, you know, in I think the San Jose area, actually, who, you know, ran a convenience store, and it turned out that he was notified that he was being penalized, and I'm not recalling the numbers, but I'm being conservative when I'm saying it was something in the order of $20,000 or $30,000. It might well have been more than that, because he didn't he hadn't been accepting, you know, recycling cans and bottles that people had deposits on that they wanted to recycle. That he had not opened up a way for people to deposit those. He had no idea that he was required to do that. And in fact, most convenience stores aren't required to do that here unless there's already like an established sort of recycling center in their zone. Anyways, and that was just a catastrophic penalties. But even, you know, the cause of action thing is the other one that just really kills me, because again, you know, so often you could achieve the very same, you know, regulatory outcome if, insofar as you're concerned about some sort of pressing issue, without authorizing someone to, you know, just automatically run out and sue. Because again, you know, even if you did everything right, you're still facing punitive damage because you're having to pay $20,000 or $30,000 to an attorney to prove that you did everything right.
Address how highly the United States ranks as far as entrepreneurship and the regulatory environment. And I would just ask, I would like to hear your thoughts on what you would say to somebody who might object to that and say, well, that can be a lagging indicator. For example, there's been many cities and geographic areas throughout the history that have been at the forefront of commerce or industry or industrial revolution and have fallen behind the rest of the world for varying reasons, but one of which can be regulatory environment. So just wonder what you would say to the objection that maybe, you know, looking at where we're at now as far as entrepreneurial output isn't as good of an indicator as looking at you know, how much regulation we've got and have that being a better indication of probably where we're headed as far as our level of entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I think there's always kind of iterative change that we can make to make things better. So functionally, these ratings are a lagging indicator, but we've got a good sight line on a number of years where we've seen the U.S. consistently at or near the top. So I would say that, you know, while we should continue to always be cognizant of changes that can be made, you know, making sure we're streamlining processes. I think back on work that we did with the Commerce Department in the past on Startup in a Day, where we were working with a number of cities throughout the country to figure out ways that we could streamline these processes, and you could arguably start your business within a day. I think things like that are ultimately for the good, and they do in fact look to kind of cut regulatory barriers that might be put in place. So there's always room for improvement. I just want to make sure that, you know, while we are lagging in some kind of global rankings in this particular space, America is still the most innovative place in the world. And while we have challenges from China and other countries that are kind of hot on our tracks and working across a range of different areas to compete on, you know, much higher levels than they used to, wanting to make sure that we ground it in the success that we see and then kind of work collectively to make that even better.
Thank you, Brooks. A reminder to the audience that you can consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the RTP website, regproject.org. That's regproject.org. And they're also available. There are previously recorded free lunch podcasts. Doesn't look like we have any additional questions, but I want to throw it back to you guys to see if you have any additional comments before. Oh, well, actually, we just looks like we just got one question. Let's see if I can get in here. Caller, the floor is yours.
Hello, this is John Hsu in Orange County, California, and I am with the RTP. Thanks to you, gentlemen. I was particularly interested if you would please discuss Facebook in more detail, especially with respect to the regulatory environment for the future, both in the United States and in the EU. I, having represented investment banks in the past, when the bulge bracket banks are supporting Dodd-Frank and SOX, it's really because they are the only ones who can afford their regulatory costs. And now that Zuck himself is supporting the heavier regulations for the future, I tend to come down on the side of I'm a little suspicious as to why. And the second question would be, do you think that the cities in Northern California will continue to try to push for heavier regulation of the large companies that are based in the Valley for them to try to force them to contribute to social causes like homelessness, drug use, poop on the streets, et cetera, et cetera. Thank you.
I can jump in real quick on that last question, then I'll let you take the other part, Luke. I think from the perspective of asking companies to chip in, what I've been most impressed with in Northern California cities is how companies themselves have taken the lead on jumping in themselves or pushing particular pieces of legislation. And you saw this around homelessness and housing where Larry Ellison and Oracle were really at the forefront of kind of pushing a particular bill. Similarly, over in Oakland, where the company name is leaving me right now, Kaiser Permanente that put together an investment fund on affordable housing. So I think that it's actually in partnership for the most part where you'll see a lot of this happen rather than a strict kind of regulatory regime that'll be put in place where companies will have to do so. And I think it gets at the nature of what we see in cities, just not in that region, but throughout the entire country, where mayors are working across, you know, kind of the private sector, nonprofit sector, philanthropy, and kind of bringing everybody to the table to really try to confront large-scale social and economic problems that have come about as, unfortunately, the economy has grown, but inequality has grown alongside it.
Okay. Well, look, I likewise share the view that it's great if public corporations as individuals want to do charitable things, right, for the society. That's great. I don't think it's as good when you see them getting engaged and actually pushing for regulation that's going to maybe stifle economic opportunity for others. So I'm not weighing in one way or the next on the specific bills that were just alluded to. But what I am concerned with is you know, what we see sometimes, you know, in the policy world, in which either big corporations or those who represent them may be more willing to either indulge the regulatory proposals or maybe even advocate them, either because it promotes their brand. I think a lot of companies, it's just part of the culture of the people that they are trying to market to, and it makes them look trendy to, you know, try and weigh in on, push for legislation on social issues that maybe otherwise they wouldn't be as interested in. So maybe that's a slightly cynical way of viewing what they're doing. But there's also also slightly cynical is the notion that a lot of times when they're, you know, the corporations that are urging for more stringent, greenhouse gas emission restrict standards and things like that, they tend to be the more established sort of companies that can implement and can actually afford to invest in the sort of technologies that would be prohibitive for someone else. And so I'm not speaking to the propriety of any one specific bill or proposal, but with regard to this Facebook thing, I'm not sure exactly what our caller is referencing. I'm not as caught up on all of the regulatory issues that Facebook is dealing with. But insofar as you have an established company like Facebook, pushing for regulation of its industry, it probably does so with the knowledge that it probably can comply with whatever regime it's pushing for, but that regime may very well make it more difficult for new entrants to the market. Again, new entrants, small business entrepreneurs are always, I think, at a disadvantage in a more heavily regulated environment, and maybe my co-presenter disagrees with me on that. I'm not entirely sure, but that certainly is my view of things, and certainly we point to some interesting research in the paper on that point.
Well, on behalf of RTP, I want to thank Luke and Brooks both for their interesting and valuable insights today. We welcome listener feedback by email at rtp@regproject.org. Thank you all for joining us.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Free Lunch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's R-E-G project.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.